580. The agriculture industry has had a rocky year, highlighted by a vicious drought and oppressive Midwestern heat. Farmers in Illinois and elsewhere are trying to make the best of the harvest while bracing for what lies ahead. As Illinois Public Radio's Willis Kern reports, the immediate future is clouded by gridlock in Washington.
Things are changing in agriculture. The fields may look the same. Silos and grain elevators still dot the landscape. But the culture of farming is not what it once was.
When I was younger, I would say to people, you go to a party and everyone has their gin and tonic or whatever, and people say, well, what do you do for work? I say, I work in agriculture. And I'd be left in the corner alone with my drink.
Kathleen Merrigan had two stints at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. She helped craft organic labeling rules a decade ago, then left to head up the ag program at Tufts University before returning to serve as the number two person at USDA.
Now I go to a party and I say, I work in agriculture and I'm the belle of the ball. What's really exciting now is that people want to talk about where food comes from, how it was produced, who produced it, in ways that I haven't seen in my adult lifetime.
Merrigan says there's an openness and curiosity about agriculture that she calls healthy. But healthy is not a word USDA officials are using to describe this year's corn crop.
There we go. You just have to slam that hard then. Oh, you got to slam harder than that.
Harder than that, huh?
Yep. There you go.
All righty.
I'm climbing into the cab of a corn and soybean combine. It sits on the edge of a cornfield, rumbling loudly at first, but not as much once you're inside the air-conditioned cabin.
My name is Doug Wilson. I'm a corn and soybean farmer in rural Livingston County. I've been farming for 32 years, and I farm about 540 acres in this area.
Wilson says his corn crop shows some drought effects, but thanks to a single nice midsummer drenching, missed in many other places, his yield should be strong. What's on his mind right now is the lack of a farm bill. That's the government's spending and planning blueprint for agriculture. Politicians negotiate it in multi-year increments to help farmers plan ahead. The process is no different than others hung up by partisan gridlock in Washington. No bill has reached the president's desk. One did clear the Senate, and critics say it didn't go far enough to help farmers. Others say it helps too much and remains too fat. One thing farmers seem willing to accept in the bill is an end to direct payments, the oft-criticized farm subsidies. Wilson will concede that, but draws the line at cuts to crop insurance.
We're clients to the insurance companies with some federal backing, and it's something that has worked for us. You can elect what percent of your crop you're going to cover. So that's probably one of the underlying issues, but the uncertainty overall of what is our policy going to be is something that makes people hesitate as they start planning for next year already.
Doug Wilson points out even if Congress and the President enact a farm bill, many other variables not limited to agriculture affect farmers. International relations, estate planning, and transportation, to name a few. Uncertainty in these areas only adds to farmer frustration. What ultimately happens may lie within the latest complex answer to an age-old simple question. What is government's role in a free market economy? Frank Lucas, the Republican chair of the House Ag Committee, says that question only leads to others.
I serve with some members who say Uncle Sam shouldn't be involved in anything. So do we do away with Pell Grants to help beginning college students get into college? Do we do away with federal flood insurance that helps people in flood-prone areas? Do we step away from the incentives that we provide air transportation and ground transportation? You know, you got to look at the whole package.
Critics say farm subsidies and other elements of government policy have often led to overproduction. Lucas says having a plentiful food supply is really a beauty of the industry. He compares it to military funding.
We pay companies to keep factory assembly lines warm in the hopes that we will never use them. But in case of war, we need the resources, we need the production. I don't ever want to get to the point where because of bad federal policy, we don't have enough food to meet the needs of the American consumer and the consumers around the world. We're always going to have a little extra, but I'd rather have a little extra than not have enough.
Taking care of global food supplies is at the heart of the Feed the Future initiative, unveiled by President Obama at last spring's G8 summit. He said there are economic, security, and moral imperatives.
Because of smart investments in nutrition and agriculture and safety nets, millions of people in Kenya and Ethiopia did not need emergency aid in the recent drought. But when tens of thousands of children die from the agony of starvation, as in Somalia. That sends us a message we've still got a lot of work to do.
President Obama's plan requires government support the world over and private dollars, too. 45 major international corporations and African companies are kicking in $3 billion for the initiative. Mr. Obama says one goal is to make Africa, which he says boasts the largest amount of unused arable land on Earth, a major food producer and exporter. Deputy Secretary of Agriculture Kathleen Merrigan says the U.S. can help achieve that goal.
All of our skills, exporting those to other countries makes sense. As we have a growing middle class around the country, American producers are going to do well. So we don't want to get in the way of progress for these countries, because what's good for them will be good for us.
Merrigan says many factors control the world's future food availability, including international politics, decreasing water supplies, production challenges, and distribution problems. She says a major player in tackling some of those issues is technology. That's the subject of our next report tomorrow. I'm Willis Kern.
To hear an extended interview with Livingston County farmer Doug Wilson and acting Illinois Agricultural Director Bob Fleeter, visit will.illinois.edu. Voters who are undecided about this year's presidential race are pretty hard to find. Here in Illinois, pollsters have estimated they make up just about 4 to 8% of the electorate. But national presidential campaigns spend a lot of time and money trying to reach that tiny group of voters. So what does it take to swing a swing voter? Illinois Public Radio's Alex Keefe intends to find out.
It's not easy being an undecided voter this election season. Even Saturday Night Live recently lampooned the undecideds with a fake campaign issues ad, portraying them as, well, a little out of touch.
Before you get our vote, you're going to have to answer some questions.
When is the election? How soon do we have to decide?
Who is the president right now? Is he or she running?
Can women vote? Because if not, as a woman, I've got a big problem with that.
50-year-old Bridget Kearns is herself a woman and an undecided voter. She says she's used to getting flack from friends and relatives on either side of the aisle.
Basically, the one party will call me whatever slurs go with the other party.
Kearns is a library technician from Schaumburg, where she lives in a house with her mom, four birds, a couple of cats, and a dog. We met up recently outside of a Starbucks, where I posed the kind of question political pollsters ask when they're calling around trying to figure out which candidate has the most support. If the presidential election were held today, which candidate would you vote for?
Oh, geez. Oh, well.
Despite what it sounds like, Kern says she's not completely undecided about who will get her vote.
I'm seriously considering writing it in, but I'm still looking at Romney, too, because I really have nothing against Romney. He just wasn't my guy.
Kern says her guy was veteran Texas Congressman Ron Paul, a Republican with a libertarian bent. She likes that Paul has a lot of experience in public life and that, like her, he votes his conscience. The interesting thing is, 4 years ago, Kern's conscience was firmly with a Democrat.
I mean, she's probably my knight in white armor.
She was U.S. Senator, now Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton.
She was a woman. She was intelligent. She had everything I think it takes to become president.
Kern says her first political allegiance is to her gender, and she was crushed when Clinton bowed out of the 2008 Democratic primary.
Although we weren't able to shatter that highest, hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it's got about 18 million cracks in it.
There were so many of us, though, that can't accept it. And I'm, you know, it doesn't mean like I need to be in therapy or anything. It's just, I was angry. I was mad.
Puma.
Yeah, exactly.
In case you don't remember, Puma is a phrase from 2008 referring to diehard Hillary Clinton supporters.
Puma stood for Party Unity My Ass.
In true Puma fashion, Kern says she voted for Republican John McCain in 2008, in part because she liked another woman, vice presidential candidate Sarah Palin. In 2012, Kearns may not know who she wants to vote for, but says it will not be President Obama. She says he went into office in 2008 with Democratic majorities in Congress, but still didn't fulfill some of his campaign promises.
What are some of the things that you think were promises that you wish he would have gotten done in that first term?
Okay, the Horse Slaughter Act. That was a big deal for me.
Now, some supporters of President Obama have been upset that he didn't overhaul the immigration system or shut down the detention center at Guantanamo Bay. But turns out Kearns is big into animal rights. And she points out correctly that candidate Obama said he'd support a ban on the slaughter of horses for human consumption. President Obama allowed it to go ahead.
I wasn't as upset as some of the other people who had voted for him, but it still kind of like broke your heart in a way, you know, that, oh God, you can't even keep that promise?
And so that leaves Kearns thinking about writing in Ron Paul, who's not on the ballot in Illinois, or voting for Republican Mitt Romney.
I have till November. I don't have to make up my mind today or tomorrow or a week from now. I have time.
37 days, to be exact, until November 6th. I'm Alex Keefe.
WILL programming is made possible by Country Financial Representative Scott Jackson, Village at the Crossing in Champaign, committed to helping Central Illinois families achieve financial security and protect their home, family, and property since 1990. Online at scottjacksonfinancial.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 1st of October, 2012. It's the anniversary of the first computed tomography scan, the CT scan, sometimes called a CAT scan for computed axial tomography. It was done on a patient on this date in 1971 at Atkinson Morley's Hospital in London, a woman who was suspected of having a tumor in her frontal lobe. The CT scan produces images of cross-sections or slices of the human body and enables doctors to examine soft tissues. Partial credit for the development of the CT scanner was due to the Beatles because their record label, EMI, earned so much money off the Beatles they had plenty of money to invest in the research of the CT's inventor, Sir Godfrey Hounsfield. It's the anniversary of the first ever World Series game, 1903, on this date, the Pittsburgh Pirates versus the Boston Americans. Pittsburgh won the first game 7-3, but in the end, Boston won four games in a row to take the series 5-3. It's the birthday of the social historian Daniel Borstein, born in Atlanta, not a historian by training, studied law, and he didn't write about battles and political events so much as social and intellectual history and the daily experiences of ordinary people. His great hero was Edward Gibbon, author of The History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. Daniel Borstein later became Librarian of Congress, and one of his first acts was to demand that the library's big bronze doors be left standing wide open. People said it would create a draft, and Mr. Borstein said, great, that's just what we need. And it's the birthday of the novelist Tim O'Brien, born in Austin, Minnesota, 1946. He was drafted to fight in the war in Vietnam the same summer he graduated